You're listening to Future Artifacts FM, a bi-monthly podcast and broadcast featuring speculative fiction audio works by artists and writers, produced and presented by Nina Davies,
Rebecca Edwards,
and Niamh Schmidtke on RTM,
and also available wherever you get your podcasts.
The programme focuses on fictional works intended for broadcast to carve out a better understanding of the now by exploring various interpretations of the future.
Together with guests, we discuss the mechanics of different types of storytelling to reveal the complexities of contemporary culture. Let's get started.
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 This miniseries is commissioned by Henry Moore Institute to accompany their exhibition Phantasmagoria, Folkloric Sculpture for the Digital Age, open 15th May 2026 to 30th of August 2026.
For more information, just visit the Henry Moore Institute website.
Okay. Welcome back to Future Artifacts FM. As per usual, I'm your host, Nina Davies.
I'm Rebecca Edwards.
And I'm Niamh Schmidtke. Welcome to episode 36 and the second episode of our new mini-series, Phantasmagoria, Folkloric Sculpture for the Digital Age. It's a long title. And we're here today with our first artist commission of the new mini-series, Sahej Rahal. Welcome to the show, Sahej. How are you?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great. We're actually recording. We're recording this one remotely. We'll be recording most of these episodes remotely. We have a very international group of artists for this mini series, which is really exciting. You're speaking with us from Bombay.
Just to introduce you before we get into the conversation, Sahej Rahal is an artist and assistant professor of design media arts at UCLA. Rahal is primarily a storyteller. He creates counter-mythologies that interrogate narrations of the present. This myth world takes the shape of sculptures, performances, films, paintings, installations, video games, and AI simulation programs. Drawing upon folklore, prophecies, archaeological conspiracies, hidden histories, and occult manuscripts, he renders scenarios where the fictive and the real begin to converse at the borderlines of myth and memory. So I feel like you're a pretty perfect starter artist for this series. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're sharing some sections from your work called Hallucination Stream, which is sort of a work in progress. But we're going to be sharing three sections of it, and we're going to be playing those three sections sort of throughout the episode rather than all together. So before we actually get into the work, I'm actually just going to go straight in with our first question before people listen to it. So to start things off, can you tell us a little bit about Hallucination Stream? Because the document kind of examines different forms of illusion by telling stories and provides specific settings before you kind of get into the story. And each section is also accompanied by an illusion axis diagram. We can share this document in the show notes for anyone who wants to read it. It kind of sits somewhere between a screenplay or a script, but then also something like a kind of academic methodology. So I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit where the desire for this study of illusion kind of came from and maybe what it's sort of working towards.
Thank you, Nina. So Hallucination Stream was originally written for a book that Blaft Publications in Chennai published. It's called the Blaft Anthology of Anti-Caste Sci-Fi, SF, so speculative fiction. It's a collection of stories that sort of confront caste through, like, or interrogate caste through, like, a speculative lens, like, you know, through drawing from myth, sci-fi, you know, reimagining, like, stories that have, like, you know, or even urban legends around caste and how they've sort of materialized, you know, on the everyday. So the stories that I shared as part of the anthology, Hallucination Stream, is essentially a collection of, I guess you could call them microfictions. They're kind of disjointed. They have a sort of hold to them, but they're essentially looking at how the kind of mythology, the sort of, there's this kind of cosmic anatomy of caste that sort of the idea of caste or like the caste system itself sort of rests on and is then, you know, kind of propagated. So unlike other forms of oppression, I guess you could say caste is premised solely on a myth, and it's a myth of this cosmic man at the center of the universe and his, like, you know, kind of body and like his anatomy kind of gives rise to the caste hierarchy. So his head gives rise to the high caste Brahmins, and the further down you go, you get, like, you know, the lower castes. And essentially what happens is people who do not belong to this cosmic hierarchy do not belong to society, and you see this kind of getting sort of taking concrete shape in the form of, like, you know, citizenship laws, and yeah, like it's sort of becoming like sort of a hyperstition essentially, like, you know, it's this kind of made up story that, like, you know, becomes real. I just want to roll back on, like, you know, something I said, like, you know, I mean, other forms of bigotry aren't necessarily valid because they might have, like, you know, something like skin color or, like, you know, I don't know, sexual orientation attached to them. They're still narratives.
Yeah, but I think there can be a sense of them being backed up by some ridiculous or sort of fake forms of enlightenment sciences to sort of qualify or validate the bigotry in question. Whereas I think what's quite different about this is there isn't that same attempt, or that attempt is made through this kind of mythology or through this sort of folklore, as you're sort of expanding upon in this text.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, to phrase it differently, I guess, like, you know, there's a lot of hallucination and myth-making that happens behind, like, you know, other forms of, like, bigotry, like, you know, like, racism or, like, you know. But the lore behind caste is, like, way more thicker, like, you know, and you have fan fiction and things like that playing out, like, even now in, like, you know, Silicon Valley, for example. The idea behind it is, like, the story is kind of, like, told to you with these, like, you know, kind of gods and demons and, like, you know, epic narratives. So it's its own kind of, you know, that's where the, I guess, difference comes in. But, like, you know, they're all narratives at the end of the day. Where this goes is, like, you know, so this text and these texts and, like, some more that I've been writing will eventually enter this game that I've been working on called Distributed Mind Test, which, you know, you sort of encounter them as these kind of flashbacks and, like, you know, kind of diary entries and recordings that are sort of strewn across the world. The game itself is kind of, like, you know, exhausted of human life, and it's also kind of looking at, like, how caste kind of became a global phenomenon as well when sort of globalization came to India, and how that sort of is one of the many kind of strange narratives of a glorious past that the right likes to stand on, you know, and this is fan fiction for as well. So it's kind of looking at these narratives and how they're sort of playing themselves out in the real world.
And in terms of the game, how will the game, or how do you envisage the game being played? Are you a person or a character in the game kind of navigating this world, or are you, I don't know, are you an illusion yourself, like, as the player?
Yeah, like, so the way the game, just to give you a brief idea for what it's all about, is, like, you play as one of, like, a three-legged kind of tiny creature that's kind of crystalline in shape, and you're wandering through different kinds of environments. The way the kind of central premise of the game is, it's a cooperative multiplayer game. The way it works is, like, you know, say all of us are playing together. So we have four controllers, and, like, say I move forward and Nina, you move to the right, then the characters start shuffling diagonally, and then it has these abilities that you can perform, but, like, you know, depending on who presses what button, it kind of, you know...
So the players kind of almost become one body together.
Essentially, yeah. Like, you know, you're kind of this collective hive mind that's controlling the creature. One compliment I got for the game, for, I guess, like, was it's great for couples therapy. so, yeah, you have to negotiate with whoever you're playing with. And then it's an exploration game, so you encounter other creatures and, like, things like that. Yeah, I'll probably put out a demo soon. This gives me a little bit of a push, so thanks. Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
So if it's a massively multiplayer online game, like, if there were 100 players, say, all in the game at once, would they all move together as a hive mind as well? So, like, all 100 players moving through the world together, and what if I want to break off and explore something else? Do I get the chance to do that, or is it all about negotiation of groups?
Sorry, I should have mentioned, it's a couch co-op game, like, you know, so there's no online multiplayer, so, like, you're playing with someone right next to you.
I see. I mean, maybe that brings us quite nicely into the first reading, which will be the simulation section.
Okay, great. We'll play the first segment and we'll see you back in a couple of minutes.
Illusion type simulation. Location, Rupaloka, the realm of forms. Time, Sushupti. When consciousness itself abandons the mind to roam the universe, the third state of sleep. The Hindi word for democracy is Ganatantra. Tantra signifies system, structure, machinery, contraption, and schematic. Gana, on the other hand, alludes to a group, gathering, troop, or flock of a highly particularized variety. In Hindu scripture, the Gana are the ghostly attendants of Shiva. Commanded by Shiva's elephantine son, Ganesha, whose name declares him the regent of ghosts, they descend from Mount Kailash to populate the state of sleep. Swatantra, the word for independence in Hindi, does not necessarily translate to freedom. Sva, in this assemblage, signifies the self. Yet, it is nowhere to be found. A being in absentia, premised on a matrix of non-dualist negations networked across Vedic scripture. The self is instead neti neti, neither this nor that. A symptom of sensorial limitations and reactionary impulses, all bundled up in bags of meat and bone. Enacting such negations through mass incarceration, citizenship registers, and police action, the state of sleep dreams itself to be Sanatan, an exact simulacrum of time itself, eternal, absolute, and unmoving, denying entry to all manner of men that might try and trespass its slumber. Ghosts, however, are known to move differently. Illusion axis, state, slumber, citizen, specter.
Okay, welcome back. We hope you enjoyed that. So Sahaj, I'm going to jump straight into a question about that section that we just heard. So at the end of it, it says, ghosts, however, are known to move differently. And I'm really interested in the way that the ghosts are described throughout this hallucination stream. In another section in Spell, I'm really interested in the way that you describe these particular ghosts. So we've got Phasma, the ghost of sight, Parakusia, ghostly hearings, Phantosmia, ghosts that smell, Phantogasia, taste phantoms, which are often bitter and metallic. So all of these ghosts as being these kinds of sensory inputs that form the self. And even at the most basic level, maybe by this logic, our perception of self is glitchy and hallucinatory and riddled with these things that we can't quite grasp, these kinds of intangible elements. In that section as well, you state, or it's stated, there's this pentagram of self sense perception. And this is also something I wanted to note here. So these five senses are arranged like a system or a ritual structure, suggesting that the self is maybe something that's always in flux. So if the self is this fragile illusion built from these unreliable senses, does that make thinking or thought an illusion as well?
Right, unreliable. You know, I've actually been thinking about like how this kind of messy process of cognition sort of occurs. And I came across this idea that like Aristotle actually speaks about, that cognition, like, I mean, he might be wrong, but, you know, he sort of placed cognition, like the sparking of thought, that ignition, a point of contact where we, our bodies, come in contact with the world. And he places touch like higher than like whatever process is taking place in the mind. So, for example, like, you know, I mean, the contrary to how we see in, like, you know, like you sort of touch, say, a hot glass of water, and then it sends a impulse to your brain, and then it sort of, your brain then cognizes it that this is hot. He's kind of inverting that, like he's saying you cognize it the moment you touch it, you know, so on your fingertips. And another thing he says is that this faculty of touch, so all your other senses are receptive, right? Like you see, you hear, But then touch is kind of works both ways. You know, it's this two-way highway, right? Like you can not only like receive from the world, but you can also access it, intervene into it. Like, you know, touch allows us this kind of mosaic of expression, you know, assertive, affectionate, aggressive, all at the same time, right? And then he goes further on to say that touch is not only fundamental to every sentient life form, it is also integral to our kind of not just sustenance but flourishing, like, you know, for us to sort of be in the sort of whole, in our wholeness, you know, in a certain way. So that's happening in Aristotle. And like, you know, if you were to sort of compare it to Descartes, who says, I think, therefore I am, right? Like he sort of places thought before being, right? Like where Aristotle would then say, I am because I feel, you know, I feel my way through the world. And you find a very similar strain of thought in, you know, the kind of middle path of Buddhism. So, you know, there's this idea of Maya, right? Like illusion, the world is an illusion and needs to be transcended. What the middle path says is Maya, it is essentially the illusion is the illusion of a perceived world, but a real world does exist, right? And this real world, the world of Maya, needs to be transgressed to the real world. And the real world is one, the one that you feel. And I don't mean this in some kind of esoteric way, you know, that there's no kind
the
of...
The one that you touch.
Yeah, yeah, literally. Like, yeah. You know, you know the world around you is real because you feel it on your body, right? Like you feel the heat or the cold or the rain on your body, or like you feel the bodies around you through touch, right? Like, I mean, say your partner, like, you know, when they embrace you, you know, like you feel the love they have for you, right? Like immediately outside... Before language, you know, right? Like, I mean, that sort of is felt bodily, right? Like that kind of allows us to sort of, you know, escape that kind of realm of illusions.
I mean, one could almost maybe even argue that sight is also when light touches a surface. Like, it's not like, even though it's not like a material touch, it's sort of still this contact that is made.
No, it's very material. In fact, like, you know, I mean, the rays that touch your iris, like, you know, it'll allow certain things to pass through and certain not, right? Like, same for sound, same for, like, you know, your eardrums vibrating, and then, like, even with, like, taste, you know, and smell, like, you know, so it's all really touch, like, you know, we're just like...
I'm wondering, like, where these ghosts exist, though. Like, for example, ghosts that smell. I just think that's so wonderful. But where does that phantosmia... exist?
My kitchen last week, honestly. I mean, that well, so, like, you know, I lost my father last year, and I'm kind of living in his house, so some nights when I come home I can smell his aftershave.
So in that sense there may be kind of lingering after effects of something. Like, I'm thinking about the sort of taste phantoms, actually the smell phantoms. Like, smell is one of those senses that is very tied to memory, even more so than sight, I would argue. Like, you know, walking into your old primary school, you instantly get transported to being like a six-year-old child because of that smell. So maybe these are ghosts that, you know, they're not ghosts as we would maybe perceive them, but they're like they're like the aftermath of something. They're always there, but they kind of just come to us maybe through, I don't know, through at different points in our life when we need them, maybe.
Yeah, like, you know, so this particular smell, this ghostly smell or spectral kind of smell is one that doesn't really exist in the real world. You know, it's sort of like the memory of it is in your nostril, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, strange, right? Like, you know,
have you read Catherine Hale's book on thought? Because she talks about the cognitive non-conscious. So that same thing of, like, when you touch something, your body instantly starts cognizing that thing, and it operates. I can't remember. It's like I think it's something like five times faster than consciousness, basically. And
but
so,
But I was going to say even that's also, you know, not necessarily for humans, it's also a way in which we would react to, like, I'm thinking about this sense of smell also in terms of if you have a pet, like a cat, for example, will recognize your scent, you know, or a dog will sort of recognize the sound of your footsteps as you approach a door, that it's also a way that sort of, like, I'm thinking about these ghostly beings and this kind of role of mythology, but also something that kind of came across for me in thinking about ghosts is that role of the non-human or potentially of the animalistic as well. And these, I think the interesting thing in Hales' work in On Thought is it becomes, cognition becomes a way of sort of drawing these connections between, let's say, the human brain, animal brain, digital infrastructures, and sort of plant life as well. And I wonder, that sort of feels like an interesting point in terms of your work, Sahej, because I think there's also this sense when you're talking about these mythologies and these kind of three sections that we're going to hear across the episode, there's a sense too of you drawing together specific places in time. Like, I'm thinking in particular the last section that you'll hear, and this role of kind of sculpture and world making also relies on these forms of sort of maybe ghostliness or cognition within not just the human brain, but all the beings that would inhabit the planet.
This is like, you know, I mean, particularly with the game and these kind of AI simulations I've been working on, that's essentially what I'm trying to trace. Like, you know, where does this capacity for thought take shape, you know, and like, how do we hold on to it? Like, not hold on to it, but like kind of render it in a form that we can like kind of discuss, you know. Like, the game is literally the elevator pitch for the game is like, you know, getting people to think together and make friends at the end of the world, I guess. The question it's asking is like, you know, can thought happen in complete absence of another being? Like, you know, can we have thought just by ourselves? Like, you know, how I guess like Descartes says, like, you know, I think, therefore I am. Like, you know, I cognize the world, right? Like, it's very singular, and I don't think so. Like, you know, I mean, even we're not, like, we are in isolation. We're always thinking with everything and everyone around us, like, you know, it's sort of shaping that faculty, right?
I guess also we're always thinking in context, you know, kind of in relation to, you know, the culture, the geography, the kind of, even like the gender in our bodies. We're always thinking through that context, whether we're kind of, it's immediately apparent to us or not. It's always impacting in some ways. You know, they're all constructions, but ones that deeply affect how we will approach the world. Maybe that's a nice way to segue into our next question. And, you know, I'm sort of opening up from this conversation about ghosts to kind of speaking more generally, I think, about your practice, but also linking it more closely to the exhibition at the Henry Moore Institute. And the thing that really struck me with this work is the ways in which you blend history, mythology, and digital media. You know, obviously we're reading excerpts of a text that, you know, are almost like you're adding to the language of mythology, or sort of almost generating it in these ways. And I want to ask then, how does digital folklore operate as a tool in your practice? We're starting to talk about sort of roles of cognition, and as we kind of spoke about with Sean in the previous episode, you know, folk can be anything. And I think here you're talking about it in quite a specific way. So if you could, yeah, talk a little bit about maybe some of the terms that you think about in your practice and how those operate as tools in maybe this work specifically, but also the game.
So, I mean, I actually don't see a distinction between, like, you know, like, I guess, digital and like analog, right? Like, you know, it's all like stories, right? Like, you know, or taking shape. Like, you know, I mean, storytelling is sort of like the first kind of, like, I guess, technology that we had, like, you know, as a civilization, like, you know, or as a species, to kind of, like, you know, sort of kind of like carries us through and forward, and like, you know, in whichever way, sort of like renders and articulates, like, you know, memory, history, all of it into something that can be carried forward. Like, you know, that's how I sort of see folklore and storytelling generally. And, like, I mean, video games are just, like, you know, one kind of aspect of it, I feel. Like, you know, I mean, as is painting, as is, like, sculpture, as is, like, you know, poetry, it's all a big story.
And so when you think about digital folklore, or I guess I'm thinking kind of more specifically in the context of the themes of Phantasmagoria, is it a sense of you're just working with it in a contemporary age? You know, these are the languages that we speak through now. Does that feel kind of part of where that interest in your practice comes from, in terms of, I guess I'm thinking of the sort of hive mind game infrastructure?
Yeah, like, like, you know, just to, like, you know, kind of, I guess, push at that distinction, like, you know, when we say digital, the idea is that, like, you know, okay, something that kind of lies outside the realm of technology, right? Like, but then if you were to just for a second, like, kind of, you know, think of a spot on your body, right, that isn't touched by the internet. You know,
I would say there are no parts on my body that have not been touched by the internet, for sure. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's your point.
Yeah, like, yeah, you know, like, where does the digital end and then the, you know, I guess, whatever came before it begin? Like, you know, I mean, we sort of, we see time collapsing in that way, and like space also collapsing with the internet. Like, I mean, I actually have a memory of a world without an internet, you know, without a computer as well. But it's a very distant memory. Like,
I think for me, when I'm thinking about digital folklore in relation to specifically this piece of work, this hallucinations dream, there's that one of the time sort of markers for one of the illusions, nightmare, it says that the time that exists in is the shortest instant of recorded time. And to me, that feels very much in line with what we're talking about when we're talking about digital folklore. Because to me, a part of digital folklore is a kind of meme practice, or it's a kind of like a Reddit thread discussing something that's trending, or it's, you know, all of these sort of small things that become embedded within a larger language of folklore that spreads on the internet. So I'm kind of, yeah, I'm thinking about what it means to have this shortest instant of recorded time, and that maybe digital folklore in this instance is just a bunch of like short instants of recorded time that kind of solidify themselves and then expand. But yeah, there's definitely something in there that relates to that for me.
Yeah, so like, you know, what you're speaking about, kalpa. So essentially it's time measured by thought, you know. So and like, you know, when you kind of read the epics, like, you know, the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, you have like vessels moving at the speed of thought, you know, or arrows flying at the speed of thought.
Is that meant to be faster than the speed of light, or?
Yeah, because thought happens before light, right? Like, you know, I mean, but it's also like, you know, a word used to describe the passing of aeons, like, you know, I mean, like, you know, ages have unfolded in that kind of thought. This kind of, you know, sort of comparable to another, like, you know, idea that like everything that's unfolding in front of us right now, time itself is this like kind of instant that, like, you know, is just stretched out, like this thought that's kind of like stretched out and is being kind of segregated so that we don't lose our minds, I guess. Like, you know, and so we rent time in order to not like get like subsumed by this, like, you know, instant. I mean, whether it's really how time unfolds or not is like anyone's guess, you know. This is the way we're experiencing it, that's what's important. But like, you know, I mean, I love these like kind of wild sort of speculations that, like, you know, you find in, like, I mean, in you know, Vedic scripture, and like, you know, that there's a gesture beneath them, which I do think kind of like removes you from the present. You know what I mean? Like, there's this idea that, like, you know, what you are experiencing right now is not you, and your, like, you know, kind of what you feel on your body is not really what the real world is. So it's kind of this strange kind of, like, you know, transcendental idea that's sold, because that can be extended in all sorts of violent ways as well, right? Like, you know, I mean, when you, none of this is real, then like it is of no consequence, right? Like, you know, so you can do what you wish with it. So it does get extended in some like strange ways, but just as a kind of, you know, wild sort of speculation, it's deeply fascinating. And you find different shapes and forms that this thing is being given to, you know, like you have the idea of Kshanbhangur, which is like, you know, the universe was created and kind of like dissolved in like a single instant. And then you have the idea of the Mahapralaya, which is literally the mega apocalypse, you know, like when all things shall finally end. But then you have Nitya Pralaya, which is like, you know, this kind of slow disillusion towards the end, you know, everything is sort of receding back into some kind of primordial form that we came from. So, and that, you know, I mean, they all kind of like contradict each other. So, like, you know, it's occupying a cosmology of timelines.
I think that's quite a good segue into the next segment that we're going to listen to, the illusion type story, which is sort of a semi title of the segment. So we'll give that a listen and we'll see you back in 5 minutes.
Illusion type story. Location, Unakoti. A rock-cut stairway to heaven sculpted with the faces of 9,999,999 divine entities that will be allowed entry into the hereafter, the only absent face being that of the human. Time, Subh-e-Azal, the dawn before the beginning of recorded time. Unlike the idols they carve, sculptors are cut with a raw deal across Vedic scripture. Thvastra, the first sculptor, was once known as Vishvarupak, or World Shaper. He was the architect among the old gods, holding equal rank among Varuna, who was both ocean and sky, Agni, who was fire, and Mitra, who was both the promise and the keeper of its bond, and Soma, who was intoxication. Thvastra himself was a master of many arts. He carved rocks, embedding them with unformed jewelry. He terraformed entire planets, as well as the nether realms beneath them, by lowering lakes and raising mountain ranges. He planted the forests, washed the valleys, and sanded down the deserts. This world that Thvastra shaped was governed by an economy of gifts, for he had many more presents to offer. He gave Kali her tongue and Shakti her strength. To Shiva, he gave a third eye that would remain closed until the sleep of time. And to Indra, he gave 1,000 eyes to watch over its waking. To the humans that roamed the world, he gave heft, hot, hilarity, heavy-handedness, and humility, sculpting spirit upon the entire species in equal share. These gifts and the sheer skill of their craftsmanship inflamed the envies of Vishnu, the preserver, who was soon to be tasked with the upkeep of these offerings. Roused by resentment, a critic was born. Vishnu launched a smear campaign upon the creations of the World Shaper. Thvastra's designs, he said, came with defects. His giraffes gave birth standing upright, dropping their offspring from a height of 2 whole meters. Flightless birds carried wings, blind snakes bore eyes, and male mammals came with nipples. This collection of complaints condemned all of creation, reprimanding it to remain forever flawed, a civilizational curse that has since followed every sculptor bold enough to pick up a hammer. Illusion axis. Shape, shift, risk, mistake.
Okay, welcome back. That was the second of 3 segments of Hallucination Stream that we will be listening to in this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. We all hope you enjoyed it. To get back into the conversation, I mean, this segment, looking at story as a form of illusion, it obviously really resonates with the themes of sculpture, which we're looking at in this mini-series. And so I'm kind of interested in this relationship that you propose between the sculptor as a world shaper or creator and the critic as a condemner of kind of janky sort of creation. And I couldn't help but wonder whether there was something personal in this from you as a sculptor as a storyteller. It really felt... There was when I finished reading that section, I couldn't help but think that there was really the mark of you as the writer of this in there. So yeah, I maybe just wanted to kind of ask you a little bit about that.
No, I don't think I'm the sculptor god. I'm not the world shaper. I am the one who is going to remind the world shaper who they truly are.
You're the one who's going to remind the world shaper of who they truly are.
Yes.
Okay.
keep them in check in case their ego gets too big.
I mean, yeah. Like, I think they'll be able to deal with it. Like, you know.
But I think there's obviously this, you know, when you talk about with the game, you know, you this sort of three-legged creature that you've made within the game. This feel, obviously, it's very much part of it, and you've also sort of you've created these sculptures that kind of almost you yourself have kind of mimicked this performance of the World Shaper, making these sort of three-legged sculptures with defects. And then you sort of animate them. You kind of make these real world sculptures, and then you animate them in these sort of virtual worlds. So do you see yourself in this work as Twaster? I don't know if I've said that correctly.
Yeah, no. That's what's exciting about like game design and like programming and like kind of actually like, you know, kind of struggling with all of it. It's this immense like puzzle to solve, you know, like that idea of like the World Shaper. The reason I say that like I'm the one who reminds the World Shaper who they truly are is because we all are, you know, like we all really are, like, you know, I mean, all of us who decide to pick up the hammer, I guess, or like, you know, create, like in the most basic fundamental way, like, you know, I mean, there's this idea in the Quran that like, you know, we are the eyes and the hands and the ears and the mouth of God, you know, of the Almighty. It's this beautiful line, you know, where it says that like, this is the Almighty speaking, I was a hidden creature that desired to be seen, right? And that is why I created the creature, right? Like, you know, that's why I created the being that could somehow recognize me. And like, you know, I mean, we're all kind of like aspects of that kind of unfolding creation, right? Like, and we have to kind of like, despite all the sort of ways in which we've like siloed ourselves, find each other and one way of doing that is by creating, right? Like, you know, I mean, we're all the World Shaper.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask about those defaults, because I think this is something that all artists kind of encounter, right? In fact, anybody that is creative will encounter this kind of wrath of maybe, or this envy of Vishnu, maybe, who he's roused by resentment. And so he kind of, yeah, he lands this smear campaign upon the world. And it just makes me think of the ways in which the art is critiqued, or these sort of defaults that I would actually call very interesting and intriguing parts of work, how these are kind of laid bare and really picked apart. And I think you make this very obvious in the text, you know, this idea that the giraffes give birth dropping their offspring from 2 meters and these kinds of things. And at the end you're saying that this sort of collection of complaints condemned all of creation. So actually, to create is not without its criticisms, and maybe that is a good thing, right? I think this feels like what you're trying to say. And also then to come back to your game making, the illusion axis of this feels very relevant, you know, the shaping, the shifting, there's an element of risk in there, and there's also these mistakes. So it feels like you're kind of giving us this manifesto for creation almost. It's like, great, go do your creating, but also be aware that these things are going to be criticized, because to create is a very potentially privileged position. It seems to be, I mean, from what this text is kind of saying, the way that he sands down the deserts and washes the valleys, I'm just imagining this like incredibly powerful, massive hand just coming down and like with his sandpaper, just sanding like the Gobi Desert or something. But yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know if it's like something that's privileged per se. It's just like the World Shaper shapes the world because that's what the World Shaper does, you know. It's sort of being like that. That's what, like, if Agni is fire, then Vishwarupak is like, you know, the one that shapes the world, you know. So like fire burns, that's all it has to do, right? Like, you know, so these ideas sort of embody these like just these actions without like the purpose is the action, you know, in that sense. Whereas Vishnu particularly, and you see him like, you know, throughout the many avatars that he kind of takes, like, you know, ends up playing a very like a kind of role that where he's not really that distinction between purpose and action is kind of very evident. Like, you know, he's sort of like, sometimes they're very contradictory as well. Like, I mean, if you see his role in the Mahabharata, for example, there's this like, you know, kind of like penultimate moment where Arjun, who's like this archer, has this like, you know, moment of crisis. Like, so he's like the greatest warrior ever. And the only thing that could stop him is an existential crisis. Like, you know, why am I doing any of this? Like, why are we waging war? And at that moment, like, you know, Vishnu as Krishna is his like charioteer. So stops mid-battle and the entire battle also stops. And Vishnu starts narrating to him the law of karma, right? Like that you are a warrior, you need to perform. You know, you are a weapon, essentially. You know, that's what he's being told. And you do what weapons do. Now, here, you see, so what he narrates is actually the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, right? That's the story of where the Gita actually came from. So, here, like you see, you know, Vishnu performing a very kind of, like another form of intelligence, which is cunning, right? Like, you know, where he is driving men's passions towards certain ends. You know what I mean? In fact, there's this other story that, like, you know, when Vishnu came in his previous avatar as Ram, who was very, you know, benevolent and like image of, like, you know, goodness, so to speak. There was too much good in the world that he brought. So he had to come back as Krishna as the kind of naughty, like, you know, kind of cunning, conniving.
The troublemaker.
Yeah, the troublemaker. And if you look at Krishna's stories, there's quite a lot of trouble that he kind of, you know, rise up. But then that's Vishnu, and like, you know, I mean, so you see the figure of the critic in that. Like, you know, I mean, this entire, like, I mean, how do we deal with criticism is always like a tough one, right? Like, you know, I mean, one thing that I found, like, you know, say for example, something like, oh, your work is derivative. Like, you know, someone's going, oh, it reminds me of this stuff. Like, when you look at like game designers or programmers, you know, like you tell someone like, hey, you know, I read through your code and like I found it fantastic and I just like stole it. Like, you know, I took these bits that you left on GitHub like 7 years back, and they'll be like, oh my God, you know, thank you. Someone actually read that.
Yeah, in the game world, I feel like that kind of thing is, it operates on a very different level. Like, people are very happy to share and they're very happy for you to use their systems and their storylines even. Yeah, there's a much different level of creation there, I guess. It's more focused on collaboration in some ways.
Like, you know, I mean, so that's programmers, but you'll see that with cooks as well. Like, you know, you'll see that with like engineers in general, like, you know, like people who make things like sharing those, you know, like those.
Well, I guess like being able to like quoting each other or referencing each other. I'm thinking because we just wrapped a mini series about collaboration, and one of the things we were talking about was the types of social infrastructures that kind of artists require, and part of it is that sense of kind of who are the peers that you surround yourself with, which is also things like who are you quoting back to one another, what are your like shared points of reference, which I think for many of us is also like where do you share points of critique of one another's works, kind of like visiting your peers' works and sort of making critique on that, and that not that necessarily being a negative thing, but more kind of the points at which you're able to have the discussion. Like, the critique isn't, it's bad. The critique is, how do we discuss and create these kind of maybe shared moments of knowledge, or even this cognition that you're talking about? How do we kind of come to the point of bringing our knowledge together, or bringing our cognition to a point where we can, thinking of this three-legged creature in the game, move in the same direction?
Yeah, like, in fact, you know, I mean, if you think of, like, you know, the entire, like, endeavor of art as this game, you know, like that we're all playing, right? Like, you know, I mean, which doesn't really have any losers, right? The only way the game is played is by continuing the game. Like, you add like another fold to the round, like, you know, in a certain way, and turn it, change it a little bit. Like, you know, that's the only way to play it. Like, you know, I mean, like if you start seeing it that way, then it's, as opposed to this like kind of, you know, individualized kind of thing that, like, it's not the Olympics, right? Like, you know, it's not, it is this collective endeavor that like we are all kind of like enmeshed in, really. Like, you know, I mean, like something fundamental to what we are as human beings, right? Like, you know, I guess the game would only like kind of grow if we have more artists, like kind of like, you know, everyone, not in that like, you know, kind of cookie cutter way of like everyone's an artist, but like we create like without that distinction that like particularly the idea of the contemporary sort of like, you know, silos art. This is how art has continued since like the beginning of time, right? Like, you know, I mean, it is this and then it's sort of cut away from like this flow of like, you know, just daily life. And then you have sort of narratives about like, you know, art changing the world and like, you know, art as activism, art as, you know, art hyphen another thing. Like, and those are things that art possibly cannot do. Like, you know, especially if you see the way that the world's unfolding today, it's, you know, where we find ourselves in these like forever wars and like, you know, like in the state of like, you know, collapse on like, you know, every front. Art was never really meant to like, you know, kind of like fix these. But it's more about like, you know, and this is something my brother Harmeet, it like kind of reminds me time and time again that like, you know, it's about like kind of being through that, like, you know, I mean, like kind of being through the kind of pain and the, like, you know, the long nights and the dark nights of the soul, like, you know, kind of sharing space through those, hoping that we make it through. And if not, like, you know, at least we have the poems. Mm.
So we're going to use that as a moment to go into our third and final segment of Hallucination Stream. This is Illusion Axis Rumor. See you back in a few minutes.
Illusion type rumor. Location, Ayodhya, the place that shall carry no conflict, one among the many terrestrial birth sites of Lord Ram. Time, Shameyabad. The evening after oblivion, the end of entropic time, 1992. In the aftermath of the Cold War, as Western society began celebrating history's end with all the carbonated jubilation of a well-shaken Coca-Cola, cable television arrived in India. With it, myth finally returned to the land of the living. Yet, the silent perturbations that led to this untimely return began even further back in time, in the year 1949. 2 years into the greatest experiment in democracy the world has ever known, the people of India found themselves in a nation divided by the communal shibboleth of the partition. Prime Minister Nehru was grappling with the founding idealism upon which the nation itself had been imagined, while his second-in-command, Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, struggled to hold its precarious contours together. The India that was born, as Nehru declared, at the stroke of the midnight hour, was about to witness a collapse of myth, memory and history, spiraling into the abyss of fundamentalism at 3 a.m. On that darkest of nights, the newborn nation was met with ancient ghosts from the Mughal Empire. In 1526, Commander Mir Baqi oversaw the construction of the Babri Masjid in Ayodhya, a Muslim shrine to honor Emperor Babur, the forerunner of the Mughal dynasty. Subsequently, a rumor began to grow that the mosque was built upon the sacred birth ground of Ram himself. 4 centuries later, Ram, the 7th incarnation of the god Vishnu, would return to his birthplace. On 23rd December 1949, a Muslim policeman named Hawaldar Abdul Barkat brought this godly return into the legal record by filing an FIR, First Information Report, claiming that he saw a flash of lightning, following which he caught a glimpse of an infant child locked inside the Babri Masjid. The alleged child soon vanished, leaving behind an idol of Ram in its place. This apparition mobilized the far-right forces of Hindutva, and in December of 1992, the mobs demolished the Babri Masjid in an effort to reclaim the mythical birthplace of Ram. The child who appeared in a flash of lightning was proclaimed to be Ram Lala Virajman, the infant deity who would become chief litigant in the most divisive property dispute in human history. Illusion Axis. Man takes land, makes temple, takes land, breaks man.
So welcome back. Again, we really hope you enjoyed that third and final installment of Hallucination Stream by Sahej Rahal. Sahej, I kind of want to move on a little bit to the language in this speculative fiction. You are obviously using this as a storytelling tool. And here for us, I think you're applying the language of these national legends to discuss political figures from our recent past. I've seen Trump is mentioned in there, among others. How does this kind of mythologizing affect our perception of these events or of these figures when we draw analogies between politicians and deities? Because it feels quite slippery, but yeah, I'm interested.
So, like, this idea of, like, you know, mythologizing political figures has been, like, you know, I mean, that's fundamental to power, you know, because power requires a narrative. And it requires a performance, you know? Like, power is only, it only exists in its performance, really. Like, you know, I mean, this idea that, like, you know, power is something that, like, you can actually have is, like, you know, I mean, it's meaningless, you know? Like, it's always power on, over, you know, the other, right? Like, you know, getting someone or something to do what you will. But then that like, that's all there is to it, and because it's so hollow by its very nature, it requires, like, you know, an exterior narrative to sort of verify and solidify and ratify it. So you'll have mythologies of, like, you know, these gods and, like, you know, these kind of chosen figures, right? And then there's ideas that, like, you know, hey, like, you know, even if we don't look at the myths, like, you know, I mean, say, for example, like, engineers, like, you know, they're already, like, high up on the service, especially in India, like, you know, if you're an engineer, like, you're way high up on the sort of social hierarchy, sort of seen as this, like, you know, because you're far more intelligent than, like, the rest of us, sort of. But that's not true, like, you know, I mean, look at what's happening in Silicon Valley, or, like, you know, or what tech bros are trying to sell us. It's completely, like, you know, almost, like, completely separated from, like, you know, just everyday reality. In India, like, you know, one of the really funny examples is, like, there's this app called BetterHalf.ai, which is a matchmaking app, you know. And the algorithm pairs you. So the way it works is, like, you put your CV onto it, and, like, it pairs you with people who kind of fit your pay grade and things like that. Like, you know, and the marketing around it is, like, you know, it's pairing people based on similar value systems, right? Like, you know, where I'm going with this is, like, you know, essentially, power is nothing but a sort of fear response to the kind of uncertainty and the kind of insecurity that the world at large sort of throws at us. This kind of, like, overwhelming sense of being, and on a very fundamental level, like, you know, not knowing if you're, like, kind of what you're experiencing is yours alone, or, like, you know, are you sharing this reality? Like, I do feel like it's a primal kind of, it's a response to a very primal fear of, like, you know, finding yourself alone in the universe.
So would you say that you're sort of being sort of sympathetic to these characters in your writing, or?
I mean, I don't know about sympathy, but, like, you know, I mean, and not just these characters, but, like, so I was watching the Manosphere documentary, like, you know. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, but, like, after a point, you're just, like, feeling terrible for, like, you know, I mean, not just the guys on screen, like, but, like, you know, and their audiences, like, you know, because they're just in the absence of, like, you know, someone just maybe giving them a hug when they needed one, like, you know, have decided to come up with these strange kind of, you know, multi-level marketing schemes and all of that.
Everyone's just afraid.
Yeah.
But I think there's something kind of disarming of their power in saying that as well. It's sort of like recognizing, oh, your desire for this doesn't make you more or less masculine. Your desire for this just demonstrates how alone or how afraid or how much maybe you didn't receive love that you should have or wanted to receive when at a certain age. Like, it's sort of, but that also feels like when you have someone who's being aggressive towards you, it's like quite disarming to say, oh, that aggression is not about me. That's a reflection of you. You know, and that's kind of what you're saying in terms of maybe that type of sympathy becomes a disarming of that. Of that structure by reflecting it back on the person who's trying to enact the power. Like, I think it's interesting when you had this point in particularly US politics where they tried to disarm Trump's politics by saying, oh, I feel so bad that he doesn't understand this. Like, this is really upsetting. You know, and that type of politics can also be kind of dismissive to the very real harm that his policies are enacting. But it starts to become a way to sort of like shift the language back, or like kind of, if the language that we've usually been using to describe politics is sort of is becoming redundant, as it feels like it is now. It's sort of, I think part of what this project is doing is trying to find how do we think of like different points of language at which these discussions might have the sympathy which you're describing.
I mean, you know, I see this idea of power and like, you know, the separation that it sort of creates between human beings as a like the fundamental sort of rupture that where this entire thing sort of springs from, the moment that separation happens, you'll find it in your everyday. You know, I mean, we don't even need to look at geopolitics. Like the moment you find yourself in a place where you're kind of, you know, separated from another human being, and these separations are sort of like, you know, there's something very fundamental to the way like they're kind of built into language. In the way that like we articulate ourselves, the way that like we cognize ourselves, like, you know, I mean, like this is not to give like anyone a free pass or whatever, you know, but like if you were to really think about like, you know, where does power, like where that violence sort of stem from, that darkness or whatever you call it, like, you know, I mean, we're all harboring it, like at the end, that's something we need to confront, you know, like, I mean, the kind of immensity of the human experience is this, like, you know, the fact that like we are capable of like absolute beauty and absolute horror, like, you know, that's unfolding in front of us today. So, you know, we are as much a shape of it as, you know, and that's kind of a darker idea to think about, like, you know, in the sense like we are by just our very being enacting violences as well. I do think really that art can kind of get us through this impasse that, like, you know, that the human experience sort of has endemic to it, you know, like art is that one faculty that allows us to kind of reach out literally, like, you know, I mean, in the most like mushy way possible, I guess. Like, there is that, like, it is capable of, you know, reaching that impasse. So, I have immense faith in that idea. And, like, I do think that it's not over yet.
No.
I agree.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sahej. We're going to put your website and stuff in our show notes. And please let us know when the game is demo ready, because I know we would all love to play it. But yeah, let us know.
Yeah, and we'll put the text in if you're happy, Sahej, for us to put it in the show notes so that listeners can either read along as they listen to it, if they want to listen to it a second time, or if they want to do further reading after listening to the episode. And I guess on that note as well, do you have anything coming up in the future that you'd like people to kind of direct people to? Any plugs you want to make?
I'm going to be starting at UCLA soon, so I'm really excited about that. I have a show that's opening in July in Soonspeak, as part of the sculpture exhibition in Netherlands. One more thing I do want to plug. I have a starter project that I've made in Unreal, which is on my Instagram page, and I made a tutorial for it as well, and I'll share a link with you so you can, like, you know, if you'd like to share it with the show. I've used it to make like literally everything I've made with Unreal so far, I've tried to like design the project in a way that people who have never coded before can use it after watching a few tutorials. Like one tutorial is like a 10-minute video that I made.
Amazing.
So so everyone can become a world shaper.
Yeah.
Themselves.
Yeah.
because everyone can become their own digital sculptor.
That's great. That's great, Sahej. That's really great to offer that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Alrighty, well, we'll see everybody in our next episode, but thanks so much for listening.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.